discuss, dear friends, the subject of speech raises a series of paradoxes. For the mouth that blames is a mouth that praises. The mouth that reviles and curses is the mouth that blesses. The mouth that condemns is also the mouth that vindicates. There's a midrash told by the rabbis of a servant of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamaliel, a servant known for his practical wit and his wisdom. One day, Rabbi Gamaliel, the afternoon before the Sabbath, ordered this servant to go into the marketplace and to bring back from the marketplace the most precious and costly and finest meat and food that he could find for the Sabbath. For such was the custom of our people, they would reserve for the Sabbath day the finest meal of the week. And Tabai, the servant, went into the marketplace. He brought back to Rabban Gamaliel not the savory meats which he had expected or the fish, but a tongue. Common, ordinary, cheap tongue. Rabban Gamaliel knew that there must be some higher reason, some purpose in this action by a servant, but he remained still until during the following week he had a chance to send his servant again into the marketplace. And this time he told him to buy not the most costly meat, but the cheapest that he could find, for the funds of the household were getting low. The servant went, he came back, and he brought back with him a tongue. The tongue, he said, is the most precious of our organs and the one that cheapens us the most. But use it wisely. It brings credit to us and adds to the pleasure which others enjoy in us. We use it cheaply. If our tongue is bitter, if our tongue is shallow, if our tongue is narrow, if our tongue is biting, then we add only to the discomfort of our neighbors, we add only to the number of our enemies, and we only succeed in cheapening ourselves in their eyes. Our tongue is at once both our most precious possession and one of our most dangerous possessions. Hachayim v'chamavet, b'yad halashon. Both death and life are in the hand of the tongue. Let me state this paradox in more modern terms. When I was a chaplain in the Navy, I was stationed for a while in San Diego, California. While I was there, I had a chance to become acquainted with a good number of the civic and social leaders of this city. During the few months that I was stationed there, one of the local disc jockeys became a political analyst and columnist on the radio station. And he was of that breed of men who purports to see foreign agents, espionage, and intrigue behind every program with which he is opposed. He was a scaremonger. One of those peddlers of hate with which our country has been too familiar of recent years. One evening on his nightly broadcast, he took off after one of the teachers in the local high school. He said that he was trained in a red school, that his friends were communist sympathizers, and that the citizens of San Diego would do well to eradicate this cancer from their midst, to dismiss him immediately from their schools, lest he contaminate the minds and the hearts of the young generation. A later check proved that the only crime which this high school teacher committed is that he'd been born in New York City, that center of so much sin, and that he was leading a revolt among the teachers of the community against a lowering of standards which many of the citizens were trying to force upon them. But the next morning, in precipitous action, the school board of San Diego, without calling this high school teacher in, without giving him a chance even to challenge the contentions of this hate monger, suspended him indefinitely from classes, dismissed him from the system. The following evening, I had occasion to be at a party given by one of the large and important business firms. There were present many of the leaders of the San Diego community. As you might imagine, the conversation centered for a long while upon the affairs of the day. All of them had little good to say for the veracity of this news columnist and his trustworthiness. All of them who knew the teacher at all had only the finest things to say about his classes, about his responsibility, about the status which he and his family had achieved in the community. All of them deplored the injustice which had been done in dismissing a man without trial and holding a man guilty until he could prove himself somehow innocent. And then a strange thing happened. One of those people who were sitting there suggested that it might be advisable if all those who had been speaking were to sign a petition to the school board asking for the reinstatement of this teacher until he had been tried. Or perhaps, he said, they ought to band together and subsidize a slander case brought by this teacher against the news columnist and the radio station. And I will never forget the silence which followed. Where there had been speech, it was now only the silence, not of indifference, but a silence which marked a lack of courage, a lack of conviction. And quickly, people turned the conversation to other subjects. Here is the paradox of our modern society. We suffer from too much speech. We also suffer from too much silence. I think we all recognize how we suffer from too much speech. The serious-minded thinkers, religious and philosophic and educational, of every age have told man that his tongue often carries him away, leads him into the worst type of difficulties. Socrates was once to say that his fellow Athenians were happier when they were speaking than when they were eating. But if a man sought to find a single bit of food for thought in all of their discourse, he would starve the livelong day. A fool is quickly unmasked by his mouth and his folly revealed. And all of us have often almost literally wanted to cut off our tongues because we allowed our speech to flow on without thinking. It carried us along until we were saying things which we had not thought out, which we had not deliberated, and it carried us into positions which we found to be untenable. The Chinese thinker Confucius counseled his disciples time and again that they must never lose control of their speech, because a word spoken can never be recalled. No matter what the provocation, no matter how much anger wells up inside of you, never allow your mouth to express your emotions without some check having been put upon them by your mind. Because when you say things rashly, you will live to regret that which is said. And our Jewish teachers tended to emphasize the social unpleasantness, the hatred and the unpleasantness which we brought into our world by the use of the misuse of the tongue. They had a hatred of slander and of perjury and of gossip beyond description. Because gossip, malicious or unwitting, increases the difficulties of living in an already troubled world. We add, unwittingly but unnecessarily, to the tensions of family living and community living. We add to the friction between home and home, between neighbor and neighbor, between community and community, quite unnecessarily. Bitterness of the tongue only adds to the hatreds already abroad in the world. The unguarded tongue only leads us into self-destruction, professionally, in our businesses, in our national life. Tactlessness with our tongue only lowers us in the esteem of our fellow citizens and loses us their confidence. O Lord, guard my tongue from speaking evil, and my lips from speaking guile. Set a lock on your mouth, the rabbis counseled, a lock which is only seldom opened. Because unless you do, if you become addicted to making talk, You will find that you will only be making trouble for yourself. Silence can always be broken, but the spoken word can never, never be recalled. Now, this is good advice. This advice of the ancient Greeks and the ancient Jews and the ancient Orientals. All of us, all people who have ever lived, have talked too much, and all of us have regretted things which we have said. We wish that we could bridle our mouths, that we could censor what we say, that we could avoid the pitfalls of foolish talk and tactless talk and gossipy talk and foolish talk. We wish that we might talk less, because if we do, people will tend to listen to what we say the more. What mother has not found that if she multiplies advice to her children discount all the advice, but she centers her attention on the two or three items which she really wants to get across and is silent about the rest, her children will understand the silence and will listen to what she has to say. But today we suffer from too much talk in a quite unique way. Our age would do well, as I mentioned, to listen to the advice of these ancients. Every age would. But today we suffer not only from the errors committed by the human mouth, but we suffer from the voices which reach us from artificial mouths, from the loudspeakers of our radios and of our television sets and of our recorders, which are ubiquitous in our land and in our homes. Where once the problem was what not to say, our problem today is what not to hear. Where once our problem was to bridle our mouths, now our problem is to be sufficiently critical with our ears so that we do not become dependent upon the thoughts that other people are constantly drumming into us. The radio and its siblings have brought great bounty and blessing to life. The best of human thought, theater and drama and poetry and speech and music and song, dancing and play, comes into our homes. It is wonderful that it is so. But what is a blessing is never a blessing without its dangers. And there are great dangers involved in these many mouths constantly spewing forth sound upon us. There is the danger of our being drowned in a sea of noise. I read recently of a survey of the listening habits of average Americans. And the experience of a not untypical American father struck me as typical of what I meant by being drowned in a sea of noise. He said that he was awakened in the morning by a radio alarm, and he spent the first 30 minutes of the day dressing, washing, listening to whatever programs the alarm had automatically turned on. Breakfast was relatively quiet, but he drove to the office a matter of 45 minutes with his car radio blazing to whatever programs again happened to be on that station. On his desk at work was an intercommunication system, a telephone, and a dictaphone. And when his ear was not attuned to the voices of his clients and of his office help, these artificial ears were bringing sound into his mind. He ate lunch in a restaurant which constantly played recorded music as a background to his food. He returned to his office and to these many, many voices dinning into his ears. 5 o'clock, home, but of course the 45-minute ride filled with the noise of the radio, and now quiet. Oh no, 5 o'clock to six is the time where Junior has the television set on. And so the first hour at which he is in the quiet in the sanctuary of his home is spent listening with cowboys and Indians noises to all as a background to all of his thoughts. The family hardly speaks to one another, so there's a lot of noise at the dinner table where all the news of the day is brought forth. And then quiet. But oh no. The telephone rings 2 or 3 times. The adolescents have their 2 hours with the radio and with the television. And finally, he said that every once in a while, in desperation, he would escape to the quiet of a movie. Imagine having to escape to the quiet of noise in order to find a moment for oneself. We are in danger of losing our own identity because so many thoughts of others, so many beliefs of others are constantly clamoring for our attention, because we have not learned that it is as easy to turn off the set as it is to turn it on. We must learn now to be discriminating in our listening habits, to limit our listening so that we will listen the better. You know, a person who has the radio on constantly cannot possibly be absorbing, be analyzing, be evaluating whatever it is that he is listening to. And when the great things come along, the magnificent productions, the classic music, the music created by great artists, the speeches by men worth listening to, they will seem to him as just another bit of recorded music being ground out by the radio station. Just another speech by another man, words multiplying endlessly. None will make any effect whatsoever upon his mind. He will have lost the power of judging, of being discriminatory in his tastes, because he will have lost taste completely. We must learn, therefore, to turn off our sets. We must learn to find quiet in order to find ourselves. Because there is an even greater danger involved in these artificial mouths which we have created for ourselves. It is the danger of losing ourselves. Ours is the age, after all, of the super salesman, the world of merchandise, the world of economic theory, and the world of political practice, and the world of religion. We know the art and the technique of selling our products, be they material or spiritual or political, to the average human being. And unless you know yourself, you will quickly find that others have taken over the determination of your actions for you. After all, it was the control of the mass media which enabled a Hitler, which enables today the Russian government to regiment their people and to control their thinking. Whatever field it be in, there are those who are quite willing, nay desirous, of controlling our thinking for us, of taking away from us the power of decision so that we will make the decisions which they favor. We must learn to be critical of that which we hear. And we cannot be critical of that which we hear if we listen too much, if we have not known our own feelings before we begin to listen. And that is why the more we listen, the more silence we require in our lives. You cannot think surrounded by the din of noise. To think clearly on whatever subject it be, you know that you have to go into your study and close the door and find quiet for yourselves. Or walk out of the house into the glories of a spring day such as this. Or surrounded by the silent noise of nature, you will find yourself. Others speak to us with voices. We speak to ourselves in silence. The silence of prayer. The silence of contemplation. The silence of introspection. And unless we know ourselves, know who we are, others will tell us who we are and what we should know, what we should believe and what we should do. At worst, this constant absorption of the beliefs of others will make, at best, will make us into straw men, men whose minds are hastily put together by 1,000 scraps of information, 1,000 straws picked up and culled from the outpourings of other men's minds. And at worst, we will become pawns, completely subservient to the analysis of this commentator, to the religious attitudes of this preacher, to the economics of this teacher, because we will never be able to look at their teachings judiciously, to say this I believe and this I disagree with, and to know why we disagree. They pound at us continually with their arguments. Can we counter with our silence? Can we counter with the logic, the inner logic, which we know to be right? So truly, this age of of much noise. This age of the radio, this age of propaganda and publicity and public relations, demands that much more than any period before in life, man set aside for himself long periods of silence, where alone with himself, with a book, with the facts, with his heart, he will learn who he is, what he is, what he stands for. And he will be able to stand up against the many claims put against his mind by the loudspeakers all about him. But you say, you told us that you would speak today on the need for speech. And here you are advocating the importance of silence. And yet this brings us to the crux of the paradox with which we began. Because the very speech which I am advocating can come only out of the silence of self-understanding. You and I have been partners, silent or verbal, in a thousand conversations in which those about the dinner table or those in our parlors or those in some discussion group sympathized with the underprivileged, berated the injustices of our day, spoke of the necessity of equality of opportunity for all men, disparaged the attacks on civil rights being made by others, emphasized the fact that every man is to be considered innocent until he is proven guilty, brought before the bar of justice all the abhorrent prejudices and distortions of our day. But what happened with all of this discussion? Did it break out into the marketplace? Did it find its way into the political arena? Oh no. Around most of these discussions, there is a barrier of silence, which sees to it that what we say in the sanctity of our homes, among the intimate contacts of our friends, never goes out into the world, never forces us to take certain positions where we may suffer for having taken these positions. The tragedy of our day is that the reasonable man, you and I, has been unreasonably quiet in moments of moral crisis. It is reasonable to hate the prejudiced, and it is reasonable to take every step that you can to eradicate all intolerant measures from our land. But what has the reasonable man done concretely in our political life, in our civic life, in our communal life, to eradicate this evil from among us? We have talked about it, but our talk, when it comes to action, always leads to qualifications, to compromises, to temporizing, to ifs and buts, and perhaps and howevers. I listened the other night to a debate between one of the men who proposed before the United States House of Representatives a bill to enlarge the scope of the civil rights of the Negro in the South to ensure that this Negro will be granted the full rights of his franchise, and between a member of the House from the state of Georgia, a bigot, a demagogue, a man who was not abashed to express his prejudice and his intolerance publicly and venomously over the airwaves. And yet the bigot won the day. If we were to describe it as a wrestling match, he wiped the floor with the advocate of civil rights. Because this learned, tolerant man from the North was so reasonable as to defeat himself, he could never state a straightforward position. Here I stand, this I will abide by, this must be done. He was always willing to see that there was a possibility that there had not been enough study, that further research should be made into the problem, that it was true that you could not always legislate morals, that you could not always change overnight the patterns of a society. There were all the qualifications and all the compromises. And I had a sense that his goodwill would go to waste because he had not the same courage of his convictions as the bigot had the courage of his prejudices. Why? I think because we have listened too much to the voice of others, to the thousand myriads and tens of thousands of facts which impinge upon any problem. We are always, we all of us hate bigotry. We all of us are willing to say that we want to know all the facts before we take a stand. But we have not listened enough to ourselves, to the self which knows instinctively where lies the right and where the wrong, where virtue and where injustice, where we must take a stand and where it is not worthy of us to take a stand. We must be champions of the right by fighting for the right, by speaking out in these moments of moral crises, wherever they stand in our lives, and they come to each of us. Now, I'm not advocating that we be among those who foam continually at the mouth, among the perpetual critics of our age who are ineffectual in changing any of the moral patterns of our life, about the nine zaggers who can find nothing that is positive and hopeful and helpful. Quite the contrary. Our age is an extremely hopeful age, and there are many forces which make all of us hopeful of the future. But I do feel that the time has come in our personal lives, in our family life, in our businesses, in our civic life, for us to see the necessity of speaking our mind when it is important so to do, of saying to the lawyer who advises us that perhaps we might find a way around being scrupulously honest in our tax returns, this I will not do. Of saying to the child whose pattern of life does not live up to the standards we expect in our home, this I will not permit. Of saying to ourselves when we look at ourselves through a series of rationalizations, when we see only our strengths and not our weaknesses, when we pamper ourselves, when we are self-deluding, this I am not. When we are tempted to equivocate, to temporize, to find the easy way out without meeting a challenge face on, this I must not do. When in our business world and among our friends we hear a bigot mouthing his hate, this man I will speak up against and I will silence. When an issue is unpopular in which we believe, and when there are social pressures against speaking out against us, we will be willing to say, this I believe, here I stand, despite its unpopularity. This is the call which each of us must listen to. It is a summons of this holiday of Purim, strangely, because both the silence and the speech, which I am advocating here, are at the essence of the drama which made the deliverance of the Jews on Purim Day so long ago possible. The great drama of Purim occurred not in the streets of Shushan, not in the dialogue which between Haman and Mordecai, or Haman and Ahasuerus, or Mordecai and Haman and Ahasuerus, but occurred in a small room of the palace where the queen, Esther herself, had to fight out her own beliefs. Her uncle had told her simply that a decree had been leveled against the Jews. On the 14th day of Adar coming, Haman had succeeded in winning from the king a writ saying that he might put to death all the Jews and confiscate their property. Mordecai had asked this niece of his, now a wife unto the king, to go into the palace to reveal her true identity to the king and to plead with the king for mercy for her people. Security or the safety of her co-religionists. With this she wrestled. She wrestled, the Bible tells us, for several days. It does not tell us what she said, does not tell us how she arrived at her decision. She arrived at it in silence. There was no one to counsel her. And she went unto the king, though he had not bid her to come. She put her own life in jeopardy to save the life of her people. She spoke to the king the few words, honest if artless words, which she had to speak. And her people were saved. This is the silence the silence of self-knowing. This is the speech of self, of honesty, dignity, morality. And this holiday of Purim makes us believe that just as her perilous sacrifice was not in vain, so our speech, when we find the occasion to make it, will not be in vain. Oh, all of us will not come out unscathed from the battles of life. We will not be tempted to compromise with our principles unless there is danger that they cost us something. But salvation came to the Jews on Purim Day so long ago. Haman was hanged on the very tree that he had chosen for Mordecai. And so all the Hamans of our day, all the bigots, all the purveyors of prejudice and of intolerance, all those who would arrogate to some special caste or class the economic wealth of our country, they too, if we speak up against them, they too will have their day of reckoning, and the right will surely triumph. For we live in an age replete with promise, an age of great danger, yes, but an age such as never before men have enjoyed, in which the earth, this world of ours, this country of ours, can promise us enough wealth for all men to enjoy fairly and equally, and then have much left over besides. We must see to it, and this is the message of Purim, we must see to it that this promise is fulfilled, that the promise of the earth becomes the opportunity of each man fairly and equally. We must see to it that we stand with the Esthers and the Mordecais of our history, among those who in silence find ourselves and in speech redeem our souls. Amen.